Okay, well, welcome to the next round of this great struggle. Yesterday I tried incompetently to put all this information on a small board and it was a disaster. So now I have it on one sheet, but then they brought me a bigger board. Oh well, now we have the benefit of both. Now, I want you to go over, this is not very complicated, but it's basic to how the mind works. The old-time philosophers made a distinction between cognition and volition. It's not a bad distinction. It corresponds to, roughly speaking, the distinction between the sensory motor system, the sensory nervous system, and the motor nervous system. Between the part of your cognitive apparatus is designed to tell you how reality is, and the part of the apparatus is designed to change it. Cognition and volition. Cognition can be defined as any mental representation or presentation that has the mind-to-world direction of fit. See those downward arrows? That's the direction of fit. And remember, if it has that direction of fit, it can be true or false. It can be right or wrong. Okay, but now then, on the other side, we want, as Marx said, not only to describe reality, but to change it. And so we have volition, and this has the world to mind direction of fit. We're trying to get the world to change to match the mind. Okay, now I'm going to bore you by going through this because it's important. For today we're going to talk mostly about language, but I want you to understand this because it's the foundation of language. In the case of belief and desire, you have simple representations. They needn't even be conscious. In the case of memories and prior intentions, you also have representations. But when you come to perception and action, perceptions and intentions in action, those are presentations. When I raise my arm, I have a direct presentation of the arm going up. When I see my hand in front of my face, I have a direct presentation of the hand. Now, nature, that is to say, evolutionary biology, has given us a set of apparatuses for coping with the world. And because our coping is both intentional and causal, many of these have a causal component built into the structure of the intentionality itself. And these are causally self-reflexive. I couldn't have room here, as I say causal self-ref, but it's causally self-reflexive. So in the case of belief, it's not causally self-reflexive. But in the case of memory and perception, it is, because if I remember the event occurring, then I really remember it only if its occurrence caused my memory. And similarly, if I see something, then I really see it only if the presence and features of the object I'm seeing, my hand, cause me to have the visual experience that I do. So there's a causally self-reflexive component built into the very structure of the intentionality. Similarly, with prior intentions and intentions in action. The prior intention has to function causally in producing the action, and the intention in action has to function causally, producing the bodily movement or other condition if it is in fact to be satisfied. So we have this causally self-reflexive feature. Now, the NA here means it's just not applicable, but if you look at the right-hand side, memory, perception, prior intention and intention in action, notice that in the case of cognition, the arrows run together. And in the case of volition, they run away from each other. Everybody see that? Now, that can't be an accident. There's something very deep about the way that the arrows are running. And I want to explain to you what it is. It's this. We are beasts that are evolved by some millions of years of evolution. And we are in a relation to the environment, which is such that it's fundamental to our grasp on the environment, that if we actually perceive things the way they really are and remember things the way they really happened, then it's only because their being that way causes us to have the perception or the memory. That's why those arrows are running together in cognition. Accurate representation and presentation in memory and perception require that the very thing you're remembering or perceiving causes you to have that memory or that perception. Whereas in volition, the arrows are running the other way. They run exactly the opposite. And again, the same fundamental concept arises, and that is, if you make the world the way you want it to be, you actually carry out your intention. It's only because your intention causes it to be the way you want it to be. That is to say, the world-to-mind direction of fit requires mind-to-world direction of causation. I love that, so I'll say it again. Okay, the world-to-mind, I intend to raise my arm, it's not a big deal. I intend to raise my arm, the arm goes up, and I change the world to make it be the way I want it to be. I want my arm to go up, but it's only because my intending to raise my arm causes my arm to go up that I succeed in making the world be the way I want to be. I achieve world to mind direction of fit only in virtue of mind to world direction of causation. Okay, now this is the story of your life right here on this sheet. Okay, however, it's also the story of your doggy's life or your chimpanzee's life. Where does human civilization get into here? That's what I'm going to tell you about today and tomorrow, okay? So here we are running around the woods, and this is our life running around the woods. What's missing? Well, the most obvious thing that's missing is language. There's no language here, because as I told you, my doggy Tarski, he has all this stuff. He's not so good on prior intentions, but he does have kind of prior intention. But he certainly has memories and perceptions and beliefs and desires. Now, there's always some crazy philosopher that says animals can't have mental life. You want to see desire come around to my house when it's feeding time for Tarski. He will show you desire like you've never seen it before. Okay, so animals can have plenty of desires as well as beliefs, perceptions, and intentional actions. All right, how do we get to language? Well, that's going to be my main topic today, because I'm going to argue later on that language is essential for civilization. And by civilization, I don't just mean money and property, but I mean morality and aesthetics. All of those require language in ways that we need to make completely clear. Okay, now we need to talk about some features of language, and the single most important feature is one that I have not yet mentioned, and that's this. In the case of language, we had a set of objects, for example, sentences, that have intentionality. But the intentionality of the sentence, unlike the intentionality of the experience, is not intrinsic. It's not built into the experience. It's derived. It's observer relative. So the intentionality of words and sentences, as well as pictures and diagrams and all the rest of it, all of that is derived. There's no intrinsic intentionality in this sheet. It's all derived intentionality. It has the meaning it does because I have imposed meaning on these marks. I mean something by them. And the name, in English at least, for the most common form of derived intentionality is meaning. How do we impose meaning on objects and marks and sounds that are not intrinsically meaningful? That is the first question we have to answer. Okay, but there are a couple things that I want to mention before I answer that question, and that is we need to distinguish between the capacity of the mind to represent and to use objects and states of affairs as representations, and the capacity of the mind to give expression to our feelings and attitudes. And it's crucial to understand that in language, in what we think of as human language, you get not just expression, you get representation. So my doggy, again, I have a domestic laboratory of animal cognition. My doggy can give expression. When he's angry, he barks in anger. But it's hard to see that he's representing anything. See, representation requires that there be some semantic evaluability. So remember, when you have this structure to the Speech Act, well, this thing can represent with, for example, the downhill direction of fit, and you have to be able to say such things as it true, as is it true or false. And you don't have that with all sorts of animal intentional behavior. So my doggy's behavior is indeed intentional. He intentionally barks, but it's hard to see that he's representing anything. Let me give you the example of the vervet monkey. The vervet monkey is much talked about in the literature on animal cognition because the vervet monkey has three different danger signals. It has a danger signal for the presence of hawks overhead. It has another danger signal for the presence of snakes. And it has a third danger signal for the presence of leopards. But what these animal scientists don't tell us is it just responding to a stimulus? Is it just expressing a response to a stimulus? Or is it actually trying to represent a state of affairs? I think it's probably just responding to a stimulus. It's not representing the presence of hawks or the presence of leopards. Though it'd be interesting to try to devise a test for that. But the animal scientists don't make the distinction between representing. Let me give you another example. Tarski has a certain kind of bark when somebody comes to the door. Now, when he's chasing deer around the yard, and Berkeley's full of deer, and the damn, everybody loves deer, except people actually have to cope with a damn deer, because they come and they love roses, okay? So they'll eat my garden, all the roses, they just wipe them out. The thorns don't bother them, they love the thorns. So the deer come in the yard, and Tarski's job is to go out and chase them out, to get them out of the yard, and he runs around barking, chasing these deer. Different bark. Charsky's deer-chasing bark is totally different from his somebody's-at-the-door bark. It's a peculiar kind of lamentation bark that he has when he's chasing deer. Is he representing the fact that they're deer? I don't think so. He just has differential responses. So in our analysis of meaning, we're going to have to get the idea that the meaning that matters is not just expressing something, not just responding to a stimulus, but intentionally representing a state of affairs, because that involves us with the crucial notions of truth and falsity and other conditions of satisfaction. Okay, so how do we explain that? Well, there's supposed to be a famous problem in philosophy. What is the nature of meaning? I think it has kind of an obvious solution. I'm going to tell it to you. Here it is. Wittgenstein often asks us, what's the difference between saying something and meaning it, and saying it without meaning it? Now, he's trying to get us to see that meaning does not name an introspective process. It's not the name of a mental fluid running through the mind, and I agree with that. All the same, there is a difference between saying something and meaning it, and saying it without meaning it. And let me illustrate this with very simple examples. Suppose I'm in the shower, and I decide to practice French pronunciation, okay? So I say to myself, il pleut, il pleut, il pleut, and trying to get the pronunciation right. Now, you all know that is an intentional act with conditions of satisfaction. I'm trying to produce something, a sound that matches the correct pronunciation of a French sentence. Mean anything. If people say outside in the next room, say, stop shouting, it's not raining, you idiot, you're just standing in the shower, they will have missed the point of what I'm doing, okay? I didn't say that. Didn't mean it. Now let's suppose I go outside with Pierre and Henriette and anybody else you want along there. My favorite French name is Ghislaine. I'm there with Ghislaine. And I say, il pleut. Okay, now it's different. Why is it different now than it was in the shower? And the answer is, I mean it. Okay, now, I'm sorry to give you such simple examples, but I think most of the hard questions in philosophy have rather easy answers, if you get it right. And this is a hard question with an easy answer. What's the difference between saying it and meaning it, and saying it and not meaning it? And the answer is this. Speaker meaning, where the speaker says something and means something by it, is a case of intentionally imposing conditions of satisfaction. It's a case where you impose conditions of satisfaction on something that doesn't have it intrinsically. You see, your beliefs and your desires and your perceptions and your intentions, they have intentionality intrinsically. It's part of what it is to be this visual experience that it has conditions of satisfaction. But when I say il pleut, and I mean something by it, this will be my great intellectual achievement. I'll actually write a French sentence. I was going to write a French sentence on the blackboard, but I botched it up. Okay, but in any case, if I write il pleut on the blackboard and I mean something by it, what I have done is impose conditions of satisfaction on conditions of satisfaction. Now, let me explain that. It was a condition of satisfaction of my intention that I should produce French sentence. That was the condition of satisfaction. But if I not only produce the sentence, but I mean something by it, then I intend that this entity, which was the condition of satisfaction of my intention to produce it, that it should now have additional conditions of satisfaction, in this case, truth conditions. If I had written, leave the room, then the condition of satisfaction would be that you leave the room, and that you leave the room because I ordered you to leave the room. So what we've done now is define a crucial notion, the notion of speaker meaning. We don't yet have yet, that comes later. Speaker meaning is intentional imposition of conditions of satisfaction on conditions of satisfaction. The condition of satisfaction of my intention to produce the utterance was this utterance that I've written on the blackboard, but if it's meaningful, if I actually meant something by it, then I must intend that it have additional conditions of satisfaction. Everybody got that? Because that's going to be crucial. Yeah. I couldn't hear him.
How do we know that you are imposing conditions?
Yeah, right. Well, think of real life cases. How do you tell? In the case of me in the shower, people were mistaken. They thought that idiot, water's falling on him. He's had a lot to drink, so he thinks it's raining. No, they're mistaken, because I didn't intend to impose condition of satisfaction on condition of satisfaction. But in real life, you would ask. You would ask, are you trying to tell us it's raining? No, I'm just practicing French pronunciation. See, the wonderful thing about French for English speakers, no sound in French matches any sound in English. It's much harder than Spanish. You see, I mean, think of the ordinary English word instrument, not a big deal. In French, it comes out as instrument. How about that, huh? That doesn't exist. Those sounds don't exist, so you can practice. But I didn't mean to say instrument. I was just practicing French pronunciation. You follow that? That is, it wasn't meaningful. So the question is, how do you tell when I intend it, when I mean it, and when I don't? And the answer is, we have all kinds of ways in real life of telling when people mean something and when they don't. In the example I gave you, it's easy to see that the guy's just practicing because he's not so stupid as to think it's raining just because he's standing in the shower. Okay, so this is a crucial step. And what we imagine now is here's our imaginary situation. Remember, I told you our aim in this series is we're going to describe how you get from the basic reality of physics and chemistry to the higher level reality of human civilization. Now we got two steps in the first two lectures. We got consciousness and we got intentionality. Now we're trying to get something which is essential to human civilization, and that is derived intentionality, where it's not intrinsic, where it's derived from the intentionality of animals. In this case, what we're doing is explaining how you impose intentionality on entities that are not intrinsically intentional, to start with, such as sounds and marks. Okay, so now let's imagine that there are tribes of hominids that look a lot like us running around the woods in, let's say, because it was once exactly like that. There were people running around who looked a lot like us, and they didn't have a language. Now, what happened between the time when they didn't have a language and the time when they got a language? And the answer to that is we may never know, because there's no fossil evidence. There's no fossil evidence. But there is a logical question that we can answer as philosophers, and that is, what is added to pre-linguistic intentionality to get language? And the first step that's added is speaker meaning. You add speaker meaning to pre-linguistic intentionality, where speaker meaning is simply the intentional imposition of conditions of satisfaction on conditions of satisfaction. Okay, everybody's got that. Now then, there's a next step, and that is communication. You got speaker meaning, but you have to communicate speaker meaning to your hearer. And once again, I think that is rather easy, though there's an enormous history about it. And communication is simply the intention that the speaker meaning should be recognized. So if I say il pleut, and you recognize that it's my intention to tell you that it's raining, then I have succeeded in communicating that it's raining. So the secret of communication is that the speaker meaning should be recognized, and should be recognized as having been intended to be recognized. That it isn't just recognized incidentally, but you have to recognize both that I intend to represent the state of affairs that it's raining, and that I intend that you should recognize that intention. Now, there's a history behind this, and I need to tell you a little bit about it. Paul Grice wrote a famous article in which he analyzed meaning. And he said that meaning is the intention to produce an effect in the hearer by getting the hearer to recognize the intention to produce that effect. So if I say something and mean it, I intend to produce an effect in you by getting you to recognize my intention to produce that effect. On the account that I'm giving you, that's not an analysis of meaning. That's an analysis of communication. So once you've created this meaningful entity, you've created a meaningful package here, il pleut, let's say, you've created this package and you meant something, then when you communicate that package, what you do is get the hearer to recognize your meaning, get the hearer to recognize your intention to represent, and get him to recognize that he's intended to recognize it. So Grice gave us an excellent analysis, not of meaning, but of communication, the communication of meaning. I want to say you need to distinguish between the speaker meaning, the speaker's saying something and meaning it, and the speaker's intention to communicate that meaning. Is there really a distinction? I think there is. Let me give you a real life example. When I was younger, I used to travel around Europe a lot, and I got into even more trouble than I do now. That's pretty bad. But anyway, once I was in Yugoslavia. None of you are old enough to remember Yugoslavia, but there was such a place. And I got to the Yugoslav border, and the officials were giving me a very hard time. And so I told them in colloquial American English what I thought of them. What I thought of them, their country, their mothers, and anything else you would care to think of. Now, I meant every damn word I said, but of course, I didn't communicate any of it. I smiled and told them what a bunch of... and now, speaker meaning, but no intention to communicate. I had the speaker meaning. I was just giving vent to my rage in a cheerful, smiling way, but I didn't intend to communicate, and I did not succeed in communicating. So that's a defective case where meaning and communication come apart, but logically speaking, you need to distinguish meaning from communication. Meaning is the intentional imposition of conditions of satisfaction on conditions of satisfaction. Communication is the, if it's intentional communication, is the matter of getting the hearer to recognize the meaning. And the intention to communicate is the intention that the speaker meaning should be recognized, and that it should be recognized that it is intended to be recognized. Now, I'm going to catch my breath about this, because basically there have been 50 years of combat over these particular points, and I think they're kind of easy. I think if you get behavioristic mistake that people make, or the idea that it's really all just a computer program, the analysis of meaning and communication is rather simple. And the simple facts are that speaker meaning is a matter of the intentional imposition of conditions of satisfaction, and speaker communication to a hearer is a matter of the getting the hearer to recognize the meaning intention and getting him to recognize that intended to recognize it. Okay, we're off and running, all right? Now then comes the next big step. It can't be a series of daily miracles that we succeed in communicating speaker meaning. And if we imagine our ancestors running around the woods in what was then not known as Catalonia, we imagine them running around the woods doing this, somebody's going to get the idea, if we do it in a regular way, then we can count on the meaning being recognized. So suppose there is a standard noise that I make in the presence of danger, and another one that I make in the presence of food, and a third that I make in the presence of rain. And these noises will correspond to one speech acts. So it can be food or danger or rain. And we can just imagine that a regular practice evolves. It's not a big deal. It's just a regular practice evolves whereby you can signal the presence of something by making a noise where the other members of the tribe have come to expect that when you make that noise, one of these is present, food or danger or rain. The children can pick this up from their grown-ups. These are equivalent to one-word sentences. And we've introduced a third element in our great story here of language, and that is convention. So we've got speaker meaning, the communication of speaker meaning, and the convention that enables speaker meaning to be readily expressed and recognized. All right. However, we haven't got sentences. We haven't got sentences. If my doggy could evolve a language, this is what he would be capable of. But you can't run a university just on this basis. You have to get an amazing human invention. Sentences with an inner syntax. And that's what we're going to explain now. Now, it's very interesting to read what these ethologists say about animal languages, because for the most part, they don't have enough linguistic sophistication to see what the problems are. So, for example, a favorite subject is the B language. And the heavy-duty guy here is von Fritsch. And von Fritsch got a Nobel for his investigation of the B language. And now lately, if you look on the web, there are some doubts about whether or not the bees really have a language. That's too bad if they don't. I think it's more fun to suppose they do. So here's what we suppose. The bee goes off and she sees a bunch of flowers and she thinks that's a hell of a bunch of flowers. So she goes back to the hive and she tells her sisters, this, by the way, is all run by females, this stuff. She goes back to the hive and tells her sisters, girls, there's a whole lot of great flowers out there and you can stock up on nectar. And she then does what's known as the waggle dance. I will not imitate it, so you benefit. She does a waggle dance, and the waggle dance conveys all kinds of information. It conveys the distance away from the hive to the flowers, the direction, and sometimes even the difficulty, because of wind and stuff like that, of getting there. And there's an amazing experiment that I love where it turns out she may not always succeed in convincing her sisters because a scientist took a bunch of flowers on a barge and towed it out in the middle of a lake. So she goes back to the hive and says, girls, the flowers are off there, pointing to the middle of the lake, and they think, forget it. We're not going out in the middle of the lake. They think they don't believe her that it's in the middle of the lake. Now, I'm not sure I believe any of this, but this is the story they tell. Okay, now what you've got there in that case is some minimal inner syntax. You don't have an awful lot of inner syntax, but you're able to distinguish between different elements within the proposition that's being communicated. And now let's take that over to the case of human beings. In the case of human beings, we suppose that the humans not only have a speaker meaning and conventions for speaker meaning of this kind, but we will suppose that the humans are able to distinguish elements of the environment, and we know that they would be able because animals can. So they distinguish objects and their properties. They distinguish objects which preserve identity through time and change and through change of properties. And I know animals can do this because my doggy can. He recognizes me even when I'm dressed differently or I arrive in a different car or it's a different time of day. He can recognize objects and the properties of objects. So let's suppose that these animals have not only the ability to identify an object as A, but they recognize that A is the same. When it has F, it's over there on the left, but then it's the same object when it's over there on the right. So AF and AG, it's the same A that has both. That is to say, we imagine that the animals have something that we know independently they do. They have the capacity to recognize objects, the capacity to recognize features of objects, and the capacity to recognize objects as identical through change. Okay? It may not sound a very big deal, but it's the beginning of inner syntax. Because we imagine that in addition to having just the capacity to impose conditions of satisfaction on conditions of satisfaction and communicate that and to have a conventional device for doing all of that, this other remarkable feature they can identify and re-identify objects, and they can attribute properties to those objects. So now we're going to add something to their conventions. We're going to add something which gives an inner structure, and there will be a difference between reference and predication, between saying, that's daddy or that's mommy, and saying mommy's over there and daddy's over there. Not a big intellectual achievement, you might think, but it's stunning in its implications because it gives us the next great feature of language, namely compositionality. Compositionality. So in our features of language so far, we had speaker meaning, communication, convention, and now we're going to get compositionality. The speech act, the noises that are produced or the marks that are made, now have an inner structure. That is a stunning achievement, and I want to tell you why. The remarkable thing about human languages, and there's really nothing like this, even Tarski's minimal ability to communicate, is that you can understand sentences you never heard before in your life. And indeed, it's probably the case that most of the sentences you hear in every day, you never heard before in your life. I'll now utter a sentence that I guarantee you've never heard before in your life, and I hope you never hear it again. Here goes. I just ate 3 tons of Heinz tomato ketchup while sitting on top of Mount Everest and singing the last verse of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, Freude, Schöne, Güte, Funken, Tochter aus Elysium. How about that? Huh? Okay, now you never heard that sentence before. I guarantee you'll never hear it again. I couldn't even produce it myself if I wanted to, but here's the amazing thing. People understood that. Even if you didn't understand the German, you knew this guy was trying to explain how he was singing some song in German. And that is the stunning feature about human communication. You take a fixed inventory of entities. They're called words. And you combine those words into sentences, and you can convey new meanings, meanings that you've never expressed or heard before. And what is stunning is your hearers will understand you. You all understand the difference between John loves Mary and Mary loves John, even though they combine the same words, because the way they're organized into the sentence communicates something different, or as you now know, it has different conditions of satisfaction. So, compositionality is a consequence of syntax. And we didn't imagine much syntax, but we imagined this much, that the animals are able to make a difference between referring devices, such as proper names and indexicals, and predicated devices such as verbs and adjectives and other nouns. So we're able to say something like, John is a man, John is on the left, John is walking, and all of those cases are cases of identifying the same object and predicate something different. So now we've got something which we did not have before, and that really is unlike animals that I know, because it now gives us the capacity for communicating completely new ideas, completely new thoughts, thoughts you've never heard before. And that's going to turn out to be crucial in the construction of human civilization. When we get to government and property and marriage and universities, all of those are going to require language and a particular type of language which has a compositional syntax. You can figure out the meaning of the sentence even though you never saw it before or heard it before, just because you know the meaning of the parts and you know how they are composed. Okay, now there's a fifth feature that's much emphasized by linguists, particularly Chomsky, but Frege was the one who initially called attention to this, and that's generativity. The compositional syntax enables you to figure out the meaning of the sentence by knowing the meaning of the parts. But now then, in human languages, you get another remarkable property. There are an infinite number of new sentences that you can create because you have rules which enable you to generate new sentences indefinitely. A favorite example is the rule for forming relative clauses. So, I met the man who knew the woman who lived in Kansas City, where it rains very often in the summer when the summers are very hot, and you can keep going and going and going with more relative clauses. The rule for forming relative clauses in English and in other European languages, and indeed perhaps in all languages, is called a recursive rule. And it's called recursive because it applies over and over, and applies over and over to its own output. It's a recurring application of the rule. I met the man who knew my mother who lived in Kansas City, and so on. You keep going over and over with the applications of new clauses to the output of the previous application of that rule. That's why it's called a recursive rule. So in addition to compositionality, we imagine that the language has generativity, that it has this capacity for forming, thank you, an infinite number, not just forming new sentences, but forming an infinite number of new sentences. Now, there's an interesting debate going on right now, and that is a friend of mine, Dan Everett, did a study of the Pitahá, which is a tribe in the Amazon basin. It's spelled like this, and it sounds like it ought to be Pitahá, but they pronounce it Pitahá. And according to Dan, they don't have recursive rules in this tribe. They can't say, I met the man who knew my mother. They have to say, I met the man knew my mother. They do not have a recursive rule for forming relative clauses. Now, that's very upsetting to people at MIT because Chomsky, Fitch, and what's that other guy's name? I forget. Anyway, there are three guys who wrote a famous article on the origins of language, and they say the essence of human language is recursion. They must have recursive rules. Well, Dan says, I got a tribe in the Amazon basin, they don't have recursive rules. They can't form relative rules. They can just say, I met the man met my mother, but they cannot say, I met the man who knew my mother. Now, this is a big debate because Chomsky claims that this is the essence of human language, is the existence of these recursive rules. Whereas the Pitahá, they got a language that's very limited. So, for example, they can't count. They cannot say I have five fingers on my left hand because they can't count up to five. They have no color words. They can't say he has on a red shirt. They have to say his shirt looks like blood. They can say that, but they cannot assign colors. And what's wonderful about the Pitahá is they're very happy with life as it is. They don't want all this crap. Dan took some of them into town and showed them all these computers in stores, and they said, well, our medicine men could do this if they wanted to, but it's not worth a bother. Let's go home. The story is a great story. Dan and his wife went into the Amazon basin to convert these people to Christianity. They converted him. So, for example, eventually they reached the point when they said things like, now this Jesus that you talk about, have you met him? You haven't even met him? Do you know anybody who knows him? You don't know anybody who knows him? What? He's been dead for 2,000 years? You know, they don't know what 2,000 is, they don't know what a year is, but he's been dead for a long time. What are we talking about? You know, they just are not excited by that. They live in the present. And they got, Dan got the idea that, well, maybe that's not such a bad way to live. Anyway, he gave up trying to convert them to Christianity, and They seem to have converted him. Dan, we like you, but please stop talking about Jesus, okay? And so he did. In any case, it wasn't good for his marriage. I don't know why they got divorced, but in any case, he gave up trying to convert the Pedaha. And it's difficult for Chomsky and his guys to argue with Dan, because he knows more about the Pedaha language than anybody who ever lived. I mean, he lived with them for 30 years, so he's now an expert on the language. He discovered an interesting thing. Earlier anthropologists said they have a number system that goes one, two, many. Okay, well, that looked like it's a pretty good translation, because if you have a sequence of objects, and you ask, how many? One. How many? Two. How many? Many. Okay. But if you go backwards, it doesn't work. So if you say this whole thing, how many? They say many. How many? Many. Then here, when you get here, they say, what was the word for two? But of course, that means they didn't mean two originally. That was a mistranslation. Does everybody see that? It works all right if you go one, two, many. But if you start many and go backwards, they'll say something that you thought was two long before you get to two. It's an ingenious way to test the hypothesis. So they do not have a number system that goes one, two, many. They have a number system that's more like some more, lots more. But they do not have any system for counting. Anyway, okay, so where are we now? We've got, not bad, we've got an internal syntactical structure. We have sentences where the sentence is the unit of the conditions of satisfaction. We've got speaker meaning, communication, and we've got convention that enables all of this to be extended through time. Now, there are a whole lot of things of natural human languages we don't yet have. But it'd be easy. If you give me noun phrases and verb phrases, then it's not hard to introduce these other things. We need quantifiers. We need expressions all and some and many and most. And you need also, I guess, you need modal verbs like ought and should and may and might. Now, the modal auxiliaries are a nightmare, and all of the linguists I know who made a career out of studying the modal auxiliaries, well, I don't want to exaggerate, but they went more or less crazy. And I once asked Chomsky, why don't you write about the modal auxiliaries? And he says, too difficult. I don't understand them. So may and might and can and may and must, serious language, we'd have to add them. But look what we got so far. It's quite a remarkable. We're imagining these people are running around the woods. They look a lot like us because they're our grandparents or great-great-great-great-grandparents. They're running around the woods. They're making noises through their mouths. And maybe even sometimes they make marks. And they get meaning. They produce speaker meaning. The speaker meaning becomes conventionalized, that enables them to communicate it regularly, and then some genius gets the idea of breaking up the units into smaller units of noun phrases and verb phrases, reference and predication, and all of that is within a structure that enables them to produce new meaningful elements and to understand elements that they've never heard before. The one that is that everybody thinks is so crucial, I think may not be crucial. It's crucial for languages like ours where we have universities and rich productions, but generativity is added to all of this apparatus, and the essential element here of the internal structure of the sentence is compositionality. You must be able to figure out what the sentence means just by knowing the meanings of the parts and the rules for their combination. Now, how are we doing? Can we have a discussion now? Okay, I'm totally exhausted, so maybe it is a good idea to have discussion now. Anyway, it's not bad for early, just after breakfast, because we got through, not bad, meaning, communication, convention, compositionality, and generativity. And, of course, you recognize one last thing before we break for discussion. Speaker meaning, versus sentence meaning, and sentence meaning is strictly a matter of conventions. So you know the meanings determined by the conventions, you know the meaning of the sentence, but the sentence meaning is, so to speak, a frozen form of the speaker meaning. The essential element in human communication is speaker meaning. And what conventions enable you to do is have standing speaker meanings, and those are conventional sentences. Okay, let's take questions. By the way, is this close enough? Can you hear me? Yeah, good, okay.
This piraha example you gave us made me think of, you didn't talk about that, but you started by, you presented first the speaker meaning, then communication, then convention, yeah. Then it is very well constructed, very well presented.
Yeah.
It is a lecture.
Yeah.
Okay. But then how does reality work?
Yeah.
Is it first that we have communication,
yeah,
then a speaker meaning.
Yeah.
The Piraha's anecdote, yeah, or example, this thing made me think of, is it first in reality, in the process, yeah, that we have speaker meaning and then the other, yeah, and then the other elements, yeah, or is it all things together that, yeah, happen?
I don't know. Neither does anybody else. See, here are two questions. How did language in fact evolve? Nobody knows. What we know is there were people running around the woods that looked like us and they didn't have a language, and then they got a language. What happened in between? Nobody knows. We may never know because there's no fossil evidence. You can't look at their bones and figure out how much language they have. But you can answer a different question, which is a philosophical question. What are the logical components that you have to add to the intrinsic intentionality of animal consciousness to get the derived intentionality of a language? And that's the question I'm answering. And I'm saying you have to have the capacity to produce speaker meaning, to communicate it, to conventionalize it, to have an internal structure, and to generate an infinite number of new entities. But that's a philosophical answer to a philosophical question. If the question is, how in fact did it evolve, we don't know. Now, I visited a tribe not all that far from here in the south of France, and that's at Totavel. And at Totavel, they did have early hominids, early humans, and they lived in groups really of not much more than 30 people in one group because they didn't have enough. These are hunter-gatherer tribes. They didn't have enough food to support more than 30 at a time, 30 in a place. And I asked the anthropologist, did they have a language? And they said, yes. And I said, what's the evidence? They have no texts. And the evidence I thought was pretty fragile. And the evidence is they have brains big enough to support Broca's area and Wernicke's area. Well, okay, but you know, dolphins have big brains too. Whales have big brains, and they don't have anything like our language, at least not as far as we know. You hear a lot of science fiction about how the dolphins are talking to each other all the time and busy telling each other what bad guys we are. I'm sure that's right, that we are bad guys, but that they're communicating this to each other, I'm not so sure. Okay, so the evidence for the existence of language in prehistoric tribes, I think, is very fragile. The only evidence these guys could give me, there's no textual evidence, there's no fossil evidence that says they have a language. The only fossil evidence is their brain, is their craniums, which are big enough to support a language. But does that prove they have a language? I'm not convinced. So it's pretty, we don't know the answer to your question, we may never know it. Now, see, one of the problems with Chomsky revolutionized the study of language with the invention of generative grammar. The problem was it's not easy to see on a Chomskyan account how language could have evolved. And when I worked with him at MIT and I would ask him about the evolution of language, he just became very cross And at one point he said, at MIT, we don't even teach evolution. You know, well, that's false, by the way. But we don't know how language evolved. And Chomsky's view is sometimes sneered at as the Big Bang theory of language. People running around the woods not speaking, and bang, they all have generative grammar. Well, that can't be right. Okay, so but we don't know how language evolved. It's a fascinating question. And one of the best articles is this article by Hauser was the other guy. Chomsky, Hauser, and Fitch. And you can find that article on the web. It's actually not in that order. It was Hauser, Fitch, and Chomsky wrote an article on the evolution of language. They don't really know how language evolved, but at least they have a conception of how it could have evolved, and that's what I'm giving you. I am giving you a conception of what are the components in the evolution. You have to have speaker meaning. You have to have the communication of speaker meaning. You need conventional devices, and you need an inner syntax. You need something that gives you compositionality and generativity. Yeah. Or maybe I should let you call on people. Yeah.
If you look at evolution, what about, you talk about bees.
Yeah.
What about the ants?
About who?
Ants.
Ants, yeah. You know, I doubt very much that ants have the kind of rich communication that we're sometimes told, because they don't have enough neurons. I mean, your typical ant has maybe 100,000 neurons, and I lose 100,000 on a big weekend. You know, a big party in Girona, there goes 100,000. So I just don't think that they have rich enough neuronal structures. But I'm just guessing. We don't know. And there is a guy who works on this, Ed Wilson. Wilson is the inventor of a subject called sociobiology. And he says we will learn a lot about human beings if we study the ants. You want to understand apartment complexes in Barcelona? Look at an anthill. Well, why doesn't he say the reverse? You want to understand the anthill? Study the apartment complex in Barcelona. There is a lot of, so to speak, science fiction going on in sociobiology, and the temptation is always to attribute more intentionality to the animals than the evidence actually warrants. Now, it annoys animal ethologists enormously that I typically appeal to my dogs when I'm discussing these issues. I appeal to Frege, Russell, Ludwig, and Tarski. Instead of looking at the literature. And I think that's a legitimate complaint, that there is a lot of literature on animal cognition. The problem is I have very close working relationships with Frege, Russell, and Tarski, and even Ludwig, harder to talk to. So I'm completely confident. If I tell you about my dogs, I have a lifetime of evidence. Whereas a lot of these guys who write about the animals, they don't really have the philosophical apparatus to ask the right questions. Is the vervet monkey representing, or is it just expressing? I'm pretty confident Tarski is just expressing when he barks. He's not representing a state of affairs. So this is a matter of some dispute, but it does annoy these guys. There is a standard textbook on animal cognition, if you want to look at it. It's by a guy named Vauclair, and I think it's called Animal Cognition or something like that. Look at Vauclair's book. That's a standard textbook that I read to find out what the research is on animal cognition. Yeah, you want to call on people or should?
Okay, so this would be, just a clarificatory question. You said that to confer speaker meaning to a string of sounds or anything is to impose condition of satisfaction.
Yes.
To condition of satisfaction.
Yeah.
So what is this second condition of satisfaction? Since,
yeah.
Given that this string of language, okay, as far as I understand, can be unconventional.
Yes. Okay, let me go through a conventional case. I did the conventional case because it's easier, but then to an unconventional case. A conventional case, the distinction between saying il pleut and not meaning anything by it is that the only condition of satisfaction is you should produce the sound il pleut. But in the meaning case, you intend something more. You intend that this sound now has truth conditions. It now represents the state of affairs that it's raining. What does that mean? It represents the state of affairs that it's raining. It means this sounds now have conditions of satisfaction. Now that's a language case. Let me give you another case. Suppose I just raise my arm and move it like that. Then that is the condition of satisfaction of my intention, that my intention action should cause this movement of my arm. But suppose I intend that now as a signal that somebody should come toward me, then it seems now it becomes meaningful because now it has additional conditions of satisfaction, my intention. The condition of satisfaction is not just that there should be an arm movement, but that the observers of the arm movement should move in my direction. Do you follow that? So the crucial point, and this works for both the linguistic and the non-linguistic cases, because this is non-linguistic, is that if the hearer recognizes the meaning intention, he will recognize that it will be satisfied only if he moves in the direction that is being signaled. So the distinction between an arm movement and a signal is precisely this, is the condition of conditions of satisfaction on conditions of satisfaction. Does that help? Now, I should tell you, you're all philosophers or equivalent. You need, of course, to distinguish between, it's the usual process product ambiguity, between conditions of satisfaction as a requirement and conditions of satisfaction as the thing required. So if I say it's raining, that sets a requirement, namely the requirement that it should be raining. But if it's actually raining, then the rain falling, that's a condition of satisfaction in the sense of an actual condition in the world. This is a familiar ambiguity in language. It's usually called the process product ambiguity between the requirement and the thing required, between the criterion and the thing specified by the criterion. And it's not a source of confusion unless you get confused by it. So when I say it's the imposition of conditions of satisfaction on conditions of satisfaction, that means it's the imposition of a requirement on the actual noise that you made, which was the thing required. This is an actual event. So there is an ambiguity in the notion of conditions of satisfaction, and it's typical. Convention and a condition, truth condition is famous for this ambiguity. People talk about truth conditional analysis of meaning, but the notion of a truth condition has exactly this ambiguity between the requirement and the thing required. So the truth condition of the statement that it's raining is that it should be raining. That's the requirement. But if the rain's actually falling, well, that's the thing required. That's an actual event in the world. Has everybody got that? That's a sort of crucial for understanding all of this, is the ambiguity between requirement and thing required. Other questions? Yes.
I was
wondering. Yeah, have a mic.
Yeah, that's a question actually. Thinking about the pidagia, and would these features apply the same to non-written languages?
Yes. To what languages?
To non-written languages.
Yeah. Because I think that's the whole point. I haven't said anything about what's added by writing. But you get enormous possibilities with the addition of writing. The standard view, I guess, is that with writing, you just get a kind of preservation over time of the spoken utterance. But you get possibilities with writing that you really can't have without writing. I don't think you can do mathematics just by talking. You have to be able to see the symbols. So written language, when we talk tomorrow, maybe we'll get there today, about the creation of human civilization, You have to have writing. You have to have writing. I mean, think of the enormous power of the Christian religion and its spread throughout Europe and indeed throughout the world. It's done in large part with writing. And without writing, you can't have the kind of civilization that we take for granted. So when I describe this so far, I haven't said anything about writing yet, but we're going to get to writing when I talk about constructing a civilization out of this apparatus. You see, here's the point I'm going to make, and I got the tools to make it yet, and that is, if somebody comes back from the Amazon basin and tells us that they have a tribe that has language but does not have private property or government or money, which is the Pitahā, that makes perfectly good sense to us. Indeed, they sort of have marriage, but they're more relaxed about it than we are. They have pair bonding with carries of obligations, but it's not such a big deal. They don't have divorce courts and all that kind of stuff the way we do. So they have a rather, what we think of as a more primitive culture. Now, the anthropologists have paralyzed themselves. They can't say things like primitive culture because it sounds racist. Come on, they have a primitive culture. What's the big deal? I'm part Cherokee. I don't mind them being said to have a primitive culture because it's true. But in any case, they do have a more primitive culture. But if we say they have a language, but they don't have these other things, that makes perfect sense. But if somebody said, well, there's this amazing tribe, and they have money and private property and government and income tax, but no language, you know, that's fishy. That isn't going to work. And so we have to be able to say exactly why is language essential for all this other stuff. And I'm going to tell you that, but I haven't got there yet. We're just working up to that.
Okay, I was wondering, well, not about this. You put the language in the society,
yeah.
Right? I was wondering the language that we use for talk about, well, for talk with ourselves.
Yeah.
This
yeah.
language yeah. is not this one. It's
well it can
communication
be.
You have with yourself when yeah. you think.
Normally, I talk to myself in English.
Yes, and I do in Spanish and sometimes in English. But yeah, I was wondering how this fits
yeah.
in
for me,
your communication.
Maybe it's a mistake, but the way I think of it, normally human communication goes from the speaker to the hearer. But there's a limiting case where the speaker and the hearer are identical. And it's a very interesting question, what speech acts can you perform to yourself? And I think a lot of them you can. You can make a promise to yourself. I get to drink a beer if I finish this article. You can give orders to yourself. Keep working. But it doesn't sound to me like you can make hints to yourself. I hint that your pants are falling off, you see. Or I insinuate. I don't think you can insinuate to yourself. I insinuate that you're being excessively long-winded. So there are certain speech acts you can perform to yourself. You can remind yourself. You can order yourself. You can promise yourself. You can complain to yourself. Can you apologize to yourself? Well, I don't know. You got to be pretty sophisticated. I apologize for the way I've been treating you. You have to sort of break yourself up into different components. But it's clear that there are speech acts you perform to yourself. Now, I haven't said anything about dreams. Dreams fascinate me, and I knew I was learning French when I started dreaming in French. Dreams in French are different. Well, I won't tell you about them, but they're different from dreams in English. So all of this is fascinating to me, but when I talk to myself most of the time, I I do it in English. Now, orders to myself and things like that. I was once an incompetent ski racer. And going down the course, I was so nervous, I would shout the whole way down, normally shout obscenities, and often orders to myself, faster, you know, this kind of stuff. But always in English. I didn't shout it in German or French, even when I was racing in Germany or France. But there is a fascinating set of questions about soliloquy. What happens when you talk to yourself? And the way I've been describing it is those are speech acts like any other. You can give orders and commands to yourself.
It's about this. Excuse me, a very short question. Do we need language to have self-consciousness?
To do what?
To have self-consciousness.
I don't know. I mean, here is the problem. We're not sure about these higher order reflexive cases. And here's an interesting question. When my doggy has done something bad and I criticize him for it, does he have feelings of guilt? Does he think I have done something bad? I don't know. Dog owners always attribute too much to their dogs. But for the sort of self-consciousness that we take for granted, the sort that you get in Proust, for example, or Henry James, you have to have language for that. Now, whether or not there are primitive forms of self-consciousness that you can do without language, you could have thoughts about thoughts, I don't know.